From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. The National Weather Service has extended extreme heat warnings and heat advisories for most Nevada communities through the weekend. Residents in southern Nevada can expect highs between 110 and 120. The average high for this time of year is 105. For northern Nevada communities, highs could reach 103, also well above the average for the region. It's creating dangerous conditions that could easily send someone to the hospital. Dr. Amy Levin is the chief medical director for Anthem Nevada Medicaid. She says heat-related illnesses have a way of sneaking up on people.
Nevada is very hot right now. We're seeing more and more extreme heat events. So as far as how dangerous it is, it can sneak up on anybody very quickly. You know, by the time you're even feeling symptoms, you may be in a pretty severe situation. So we really want to encourage people to drink water, to stay out of the heat, especially the hottest times of the day. Some common measures that people can take, because it really can sneak up on anybody.
So far this year, the Clark County coroner has reported 46 heat-related deaths. At least 12 of the victims were unhoused. To keep people safe during the extreme heat, Clark County has opened dozens of cooling stations around the Las Vegas Valley. Washoe County has also opened cooling stations. Links to those locations will be on KNPR.org. However, as the temperature and the death count climbs, some are asking if those cooling centers are enough, especially when it comes to keeping Nevada's homeless population safe. Brett Nowak works as an engagement liaison for Shine a Light, a Las Vegas-based homeless outreach organization. He joins us now. Brent, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Paul.
So just how dangerous is this time of year for Nevada's unhoused population?
Great question. I mean, if we're taking a look at the numbers, 46 heat-related deaths already this year, that's way too many. If one person is dying from exposure, we have a real problem. You know, it's a difficult time for all of us in this city right now, and you can only imagine the challenges that our unhoused friends face out there on top of, you know, the heat-related issues.
You know, the county has these cooling centers. First off, what are they? You know, when we're talking about a cooling center, what are we talking about?
So it's a drop-in center, a place where anyone can go and get out of the extreme heat, take a moment to just, you know, relax and reset their body. I think there's a lot of the times offered, water's offered to these people when they stop by. I know for us at Shine a Light, our drop-in center allows people to come in and just get out of the extreme heat, take a break for a minute, charge their phone, whatever the case may be, and get connected to resources that might help them get out of the challenges they're facing.
Now, when it comes to the county level, these are typically, you know, community centers, public libraries. Are they being used? Are these centers actually being taken advantage of?
I think so. I do. I'm not sure that the unhoused population is educated on exactly where they are, but I know that they're out there. And if we can connect people to these resources, it's a step forward in the right direction to getting people help that they need.
But there are a lot of folks who choose to stay away from anything that, you know, may reek of government or services. You know, is that why some people may choose not to go to these cooling centers?
That could be a barrier. I don't want to speak for anybody, making a decision while they're living on the streets. But, you know, if you take a look at some of these county-funded programs, like you said, these city-run programs, you know, they're all the same. You know, the furniture is the same. The paint is the same color. You know, the training for the staff seems to be the same. And so that could be trauma that somebody has faced in their past where they don't want to connect with, you know, a county-funded program. However, the resources are there, the compassion is there, and I would say, you know, it's so encouraged to get out of the heat, get in, talk to somebody, talk about the challenges you're facing, and see what we can do to help you.
You know, we have these cooling centers. Is that enough? What more needs to be done to help these vulnerable populations?
That's a great question, and I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer. I think that the community needs to educate themselves on what resources are available for anybody. Just because somebody's unhoused or dealing with substance use disorder, mental health challenges, they're still part of our community, and they still need a helping hand. So I think collectively as a whole in the Las Vegas Valley, or, you know, countrywide, we just educate ourselves on what resources are available, what barriers people are facing, and how they can overcome those challenges and get the help that they're looking for.
So let's talk about the education front. You said that might be one of the biggest barriers for a lot of folks. How do you get the word out?
Word of mouth, you know, grassroots, hitting the streets, you know, just going out, shaking hands, meeting people, letting them know we are here when you are ready to accept help. Our Saturday outreach, we go out every morning into the unhoused community and we connect with people and offer basic supplies and let them know that if they're willing to get out of the situation that they're in, we do have a long-term case management program that can help walk them through four phases of our program and about 18 months of their recovery.
You know, we got about a minute left. What about pets? There are a lot of folks who have pets. What are people, you know, what services are available for pets?
One of the bigger barriers that we face in our program is connecting people to resources with service animals. There are programs out there that do help. Excuse me. I believe that it's another challenge that we're facing in town, you know, connecting animals to the resources that they need, because it's not just about the health of the human beings. It is also about the health of the animals that are on the streets with them.
That's Brent Nowak, the engagement liaison for Shine a Light, a local homeless outreach organization. Brent, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as a note, KNPR did reach out to Clark County for comment, but did not receive a response. One group that has pushed for greater heat mitigation efforts is the Nevada Environmental Justice Coalition. Jackie Spicer is the coalition coordinator. I spoke to her earlier this week and asked her what she thinks needs to be done to make sure people are staying safe in this extreme heat. Jackie, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Let's talk about Clark County's cooling stations. There are dozens scattered across the valley. They include public libraries, the Salvation Army centers, community centers. Are they enough?
The cooling centers in Clark County are such an important resource and definitely something that we should continue to have, but there is room to expand that kind of program to reach more people.
How so?
So as you mentioned, the cooling centers we currently have are community centers, libraries, a few other places sprinkled in. They're very spread out, for one thing, and there are not a lot of folks who know about them. So one thing that the Nevada Environmental Justice Coalition has been doing over the last few years is we host listening sessions and surveys with community members, and we do this project in partnership with the Public Communications Initiative at UNLV to ask people how they are experiencing extreme heat, how they utilize resources. A lot of the times we hear from community members that they have either never heard of a cooling center, or they don't know how to find one, or if they live near one, perhaps, that maybe they don't know what it's for. And a lot of people do utilize the resources. They go to the library, they go to the community centers, not even realizing that it is a cooling center. These are just places people can go, and the cooling centers provide a water bottle for folks. But we could use a lot more. The biggest missing piece in Nevada is funding. Right now, all the cooling centers that we have are unfunded in Clark County, hence why they are at public locations like libraries. But that funding could also be used to improve and expand cooling centers so we could have more locations, provide more resources. A lot of these locations do not have resources that could direct people to other services like housing assistance or food services, unless they are at a library or something that already has those there. In addition to that, cooling centers in Clark County do not have paid medical staff on site. They are often managed by volunteers who share the water. But if someone's having a heat emergency and they are seeking a cooling center, then they would need someone who is medically trained or a nurse, someone who can identify those symptoms and actually help people recover or get the help that they need in those situations. So funding could help with that. We also need cooling centers that operate outside of standard business hours. So the libraries and community centers obviously close at a certain point in the evening. And in Clark County, we have significant overnight extreme heat temperatures as well. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, if people are getting kicked out of a cooling center, if they even know it's a cooling center, then they're essentially just out on the street. If people cannot afford a hotel for the night or somewhere to stay, we have thousands of folks who are unsheltered at any given day in Southern Nevada. And where do they go? So we do need more 24-hour support so people have somewhere overnight to stay. A lot of times we have heard from community members who, regardless of their housing situation, if they have pets and if they're outside or if they're in their home and their AC breaks down, suddenly they and their pets are in danger. And if people can't go to a cooling center with their pet, then they are going to be making other choices that keep them with their pet. People don't want to abandon their pet. That's dangerous and scary. So if we had additional funding, we could be doing more to improve and expand the cooling centers that we have here, and also to do more heat mitigation efforts in our communities beyond cooling centers. We don't want those to be the end-all be-all of the resources that are available to people.
Jackie Spicer is the coalition coordinator for the Nevada Environmental Justice Coalition. Jackie, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You can find more information on your community's cooling centers on our website, knpr.org. It might feel like summer is here to stay, but for students across the state, the end of summer is rapidly approaching. That's because for most students in the state, roughly 340,000 of them enrolled in Clark and Washoe counties, the first day of the new year is next Monday, August 10th. And one big change that parents in Southern Nevada will have to deal with this year is the new staggered start times, pushing that first bell back anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes compared to previous year's start times. To better understand why the district made the change and to get the latest on what else parents should expect from Nevada's largest school district, I spoke with CCSD Superintendent Joan Ebert. Here's that conversation. Superintendent Ebert, thanks for chatting with me.
Thank you for having me, as always.
I think the biggest change most parents are thinking about this new school year are the new start times. So let's dive into that for a moment, because it seems like there are still a lot of frustrated parents. Why was that change implemented?
Yeah, so all of the research shows is a combination of many things, but we'll start with the research for our high school students. We had the earliest start time in the nation, 7 a.m. We had, you know, expectation that all the children, all the adults would be sitting in their seats at 7 a.m. ready to learn. And all the research shows that that is not the case for our high school students. So we went out and did a survey, 45,000 people responded, and then took that information along with the research and selected the best start times for our context.
What sort of impact are you hoping comes out of this? Is it more behavioral? Is it more academic?
Academic, 100%. You know, there are other pieces that research shows around the country that around high school students driving, there are less accidents because they are ready to, you know, hit the road running. Also increased student achievement, as well as the ability to still participate in extracurricular sports, all of those pieces. So we're really excited about the opportunity. You know, with 280,000 children, I don't know anyone that can make all 100% of them happy, the parents, but we definitely do our best, and our job is to educate. And so that's what we're doing in the best situation for them.
Just how big of an undertaking is this, moving all these start times back for all of the schools? Is it just simply a matter of looking at the day book and moving everything back an hour, or has this been a lot of planning, restructuring? What has gotten into this?
So we started this last fall, right, with our surveys back in October to see, because originally we're going to do exactly what you said. We were just going to move everybody back an hour or half an hour, I think it was, 7:30, 8:30, 9:30. And that was an all resounding no. It's like, okay, I guess that would have been a solution that didn't require a lot of moving parts. And so then we went back out and did that work with our routing. We do run the largest school transportation system in the nation. So it is no easy feat with, running about 1,200 routes every single day. We move over 100,000 children. And so making sure they're safe, they're on school, at school on time. And then working with, we received input from all of our municipalities, from the city of Henderson, Boulder City, North Las Vegas, the county themselves. We had meetings with all of them, because they also provide supports after school, Boys and Girls Club, Safe Key. And so making sure that there weren't any blind spots, quite frankly, that we had to making sure that all of those pieces were still in place. And we did get feedback from them. I think we adjusted from, I think City of Henderson and Las Vegas had some feedback, and we made those adjustments. They're all getting ready with the crossing guards this year. So it is moving forward.
I'm glad you brought up the crossing guards, because last year hundreds of students were struck by vehicles as they were traveling to and from school. What is the district doing to avoid those collisions?
Yeah, so we got together with the municipalities. Clark County themselves was the lead on the report that was just published. It was presented to Clark County commissioners about 4 weeks ago. Actually, this Wednesday night, it's going to be presented to our own school board of trustees. So police officers from all of the local jurisdictions, our principals, we had parent input, student input, making sure that students understand when they're traveling to and from school, when they're even walking to and from school, not necessarily driving, but they need to be paying attention to their surroundings and not, just looking at their cell phone. Also e-bikes, e-scooters, those are fairly new to the system in and around schools. That helmets, we worked with our local hospitals. A lot of what they were saying is that a lot of parents, even though they're buying their children helmets for those devices, they are not helmets that are rated for, they're buying bicycle helmets for a device that's going, 25 miles an hour. And so making sure that parents are aware, our students are aware, our drivers around our school, we're very fortunate that Assembly Bill 6 passed during the special session. So as of July 1st, just over a month ago, U-turns, double the points, and the penalties within school zones have changed. And so, the behavior of the drivers, the behavior of our children going to and for school is what we're working on, awareness especially.
In the spring, the district, the board approved the district's new strategic plan. How have you used the summer to implement that plan moving forward?
Oh my goodness. Everybody's been working very, very hard. We had over 300 principals weigh in. Once the goals were set in the strategic plan for the 5 years, how are we going to get there? What are the resources that principals need? And so we are working together with our principals in the implementation, had a principal meeting this morning. What is it that your staff that you need as a professional, or that your staff needs? Is it professional development? Is it additional ideas on how to career connected learning is our priority number two. In an elementary school, how do you link career to the work that their students, beyond just being a fireman or a police officer or a teacher? We have advanced manufacturing here in the Valley. And you think about all the STEM work that goes into it. So we've been working with, alongside of all our principals, teachers report this week. So we're really excited to lift all of that up. Academic excellence, and then safe and supportive schools. Just hired a new school police chief Clark, graduate of Cimarron Memorial High School. And so we've got a lot of changes there going on as well.
At the end of the day, You know, is all of that going to amount to seeing better math, reading, writing scores?
Yes, 100%. Moving up, when you think about a strategic plan, and this is my second time in the Clark County School District, over time, right? It's not just a straight line for increases. So you think about it like an investment. You know, you travel upward, maybe there's a little flat component within it, and then you get another big jump. And that's what we fully expect. So by the time in 5 years, 2031, we will have 100% of our students graduating with a marketable asset. Today, we have children that graduate that aren't quite sure what their path is going to be. And we want to make sure they have direction, not just a diploma. And so that being there, the increased 60% in our literacy rate, that has to happen. That's not an if or a maybe. It is a definite goal and that we need to achieve for our children. And that's going to take our entire community, as well as our parents, making sure that we're supporting our children so they can become literate.
At the bare minimum, what do families need to do to ensure that their child has a successful new school year?
Be engaged. I know I have a parent advisory group, and they talk about how they would like to have more information. So making sure you know your child's teachers, making sure your child gets to school every single day. We want to make sure that they are there with an educator, learning their literacy skills, learning their mathematics, and having fun too while they're at school. And all of those components of being engaged, asking about their child's homework, connecting with their teacher, connecting with the school principal, what's coming up. I think there is a portion, you know, during the pandemic where parents kind of step back. And you know, rightly so in that context, but we need them to fully step up and understand what their teacher is working with their student on. They may be really doing really well in literacy, but not so well in mathematics. And parents need to understand exactly the level that their child is at, if they're at grade level, and if they're not, to help them after school on weekends, making sure that they receive tutoring and support.
Superintendent Ebert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Students in Washoe County are also experiencing some changes this school year. Just last week, WCSD, the second largest district in the state, announced plans to introduce a new program called Zoom ahead of the upcoming year. It allows parents, principals, and transportation staff within the district to monitor students' bus rides to and from campus. Students enrolled in the program scan a school ID card or app when they board and exit the school bus. The system electronically records attendance and sends notifications to parents through an app. To learn more about what the district is hoping to achieve with this app, I spoke with Adam Searcy, Chief Operations Officer for Washoe County Schools. Adam, thank you for joining me.
Absolutely, thanks.
One of the newest developments for this school year is the development of the Zoom program. It allows parents to track their students' movements as they travel to and from school on the school bus. What is that program and why is it needed?
Yeah, first of all, I want to walk back the characterization of tracking students' movements. This is, you know, like Uber for student transportation. It's needed because the district is charged with the safe care and transport of thousands of students on a daily basis to and from school. And we have the technology and the ability to apply it into that service so that students and parents and school administrators can receive notifications on the status of the bus to and from the stop, and that we can take electronic attendance, essentially, of the students boarding the bus and getting off the bus. it's a huge improvement in student safety and just customer service, so that the people that need to know what's going on with their students and our buses are able to be notified more timely and more accurately.
So how does it work?
Well, so there's a software that our transportation department utilizes across the entire fleet. So they are developing the bus routes within this platform, and they are monitoring the status of every individual bus so that they know how all of these routes are going. Drilling in a little bit more towards the individual user, our principals, our school secretaries will now have access to the status of all of the buses and the ridership information associated with the routes or the buses at their schools. So what historically has been a phone call to the front office of a school, hey, what's, you know, my bus is late, you know, the school administration is the, you know, the primary source of information and truth for our families. So we want to arm them with this information directly. They will now have access, they, principals, school secretaries, et cetera, will have access to essentially the same amount of information relative to their school that our transportation dispatch team has currently as well. Then the next level will be the parents. So whether a student is electronically scanning onto the bus with a RFID card, a bus pass, or using their personal device, the parent, after downloading the app and creating an account associated with their student, their rider, can receive notifications of your bus is approaching, your student has electronically scanned onto the bus, and they can follow the status of that ride until it reaches their destination, and receive a notification that their student has exited the bus. Similarly, the student can download an app associated with their student ID profile, receive those notifications. Hey, your bus is coming in 15 minutes. It's on time. Or your bus is running 15 minutes late, just, you know, so you know. And then the same thing, scanning on and off a bus, things of that nature. There's also for the drivers, so similar to your Uber ride, there's a headshot of your driver. So occasionally, if there's a substitute driver or whatever, hey, your regular driver, you know, Paul's not driving, smiley face Adam is going to be your driver today. So it's a nice kind of customer service approach. And those drivers on the in the bus is a tablet mounted on the dash that will give our drivers turn-by-turn directions. So in the instance where there is a substitute bus driver and, you know, maybe they're not as familiar with that local route, they're going to be receiving turn-by-turn directions for that specific bus route. Just like you or I would drive our personal vehicles around with Google Maps, we now have that added layer of safety for our drivers.
At that same time, there are plenty of parents who are very concerned about their children's data. You know, what safeguards are in place to make sure that this data is safe and remains secure, that people aren't finding out when kids are getting off the school bus?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, it is worth noting that this program is entirely optional participation-wise. I mean, if you are eligible for transportation, you show up at the bus stop, we're going to give you a ride no matter what. So you can, this is an opt-in sort of additional layer that we're offering this school year. Zoom Transportation is our partner, you know, went through an extensive vetting process in terms of their data privacy standards and whatnot. They actually operate school transportation departments across the nation, many other large school districts across the nation. So they're very accustomed to these expectations in terms of not only operating the bus, but the student data privacy. All of these accounts are specifically tied to the student profile. So Infinite Campus is our student database and the student ID number. So, you know, the only people with access to that information are either the parent or guardian and that student. And then all other data privacy standards for these types of softwares, as well as, you know, student information, Zoom is compliant with all of those types of requirements.
Adam, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks.
In a city full of extravagant casino properties, there's none more legendary than Caesar's Palace. And today, August 5th, it celebrates its 60th anniversary. Caesar's has not only influenced so many other casinos and spawned a huge entertainment company bearing its name, it's made a huge imprint on pop culture. Earlier this week, KNPR's Mike Pravat discussed Caesar's legacy with UNLV Ombuds professor and gaming historian David Schwartz, as well as Las Vegas Weekly senior producer Jeff Carter.
David Schwartz, thanks for making the time.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So, David, on a boulevard that has seen so many casinos come and go and be completely reimagined, if you had to pick the single biggest factor for why Caesar's Palace has stuck around for so long, what would it be?
I think a lot of it is because of the allure and because of the brand that came out of Caesar's. You know, it's not just a building, it's a whole idea.
You know, the line with Caesar's is that it set the precedent for all the casinos that followed. You know, the strip and the casinos have changed a lot since the 1960s. I'm wondering if maybe it's more that Caesar's evolution and the additions that keep coming also keep influencing future properties over the decades. Do you think that's also going on?
I think it does, because if you think about what Caesar's was when it opened, it was impressive to be sure, but there's not much. But if you think about all the things that have been added since then, you know, the forum shops, a lot of the food and beverage, there's just so much more stuff. The Coliseum, all that, you know, it's just a whole other package.
So let's go back to 1962 and the subject of your 2013 book, Grandissimo, the First Emperor of Las Vegas. What possesses this motel entrepreneur named Jay Sarno to borrow more than $10 million from a Teamsters fund to go big on Las Vegas Boulevard?
Well, what inspired him was he went to Vegas for the first time and had a terrible time. He just thought the city was boring. He thought it was so plain. He thought it was just unexceptional and said, wow, they should do better. More importantly, I can do better.
And I take it this was wildly different than anything he had ever done before, correct?
It was definitely an evolution. You know, he'd done his motels and hotels were getting progressively a little bit more like Caesar's Palace, but definitely doing it in Vegas with a casino was a whole other level.
Now, interestingly, Jay Sarno lost his crown jewel only 3 years after it opened. So what happened?
Yeah, well, what happened was it was hard for the people who were working with Jay and Jay to get along. And, you know, at one point, pretty much everybody was unhappy. So even though the casino was making a lot of money, Jay wanted to do something different. And he had the idea for Circus Circus and went off and did that. And then they were able to sell Caesar's to Lums in 1969.
And of course, that property has changed hands a lot over the years. Now, David, Jay had picked the Roman Empire as a theme, and, you know, as we all know, that property really committed to it. It's my understanding that despite the older casinos having loosely incorporated various desert and tropical and Western themes, Caesar's was really the first escapist theming for a Las Vegas casino. What did Sarno and his crew do differently to accomplish that?
Well, one thing they did is they took the idea of ancient Rome and weaved it into everything. So everything from the uniforms that employees wore to the stationery to the design, you know, and really it was that this immersive experience before people even talked in terms as pretentious as that. So it was the idea that you would basically wrap yourself in a departed world where you were the center of attention.
Now, Caesar's was a hit upon opening on August 5th, 1966. It wasn't exactly the only big kahuna on the strip, as the Aladdin had opened a few months later. And I think within about 7 years, we'd see Circus Circus, which, as you said, also was opened by Jay Sarno. The record-breaking International, which we now know as the Westgate. And the first MGM Grand, which is now the Horseshoe. But, you know, Caesar's remained the one property most synonymous with Las Vegas. What was it doing at the time that just kept it so hot?
Well, I think a couple things. First of all, you know, the name Caesar's Palace and the whole image, it's very easy to remember. So something like the International, great property, not quite as memorable, not quite as, you know, vivid for a lot of people. So if somebody wants to think of a casino in Vegas, yeah, you're going to think of the place with the togas and all that, which is Caesar's Palace. So I think that had that going for it. Also, a lot of very careful marketing, everything from boxing, elite boxing became a big deal in the 70s. Tennis also became a pretty big deal. So there was a lot of conscious effort put into marketing property.
Now, David, you had interviewed Evel Knievel for your book. He famously jumped the fountains out front with a motorcycle in 1967, and that set the stage for more bike jumps and boxing matches and even on-site F1 races at Caesars. It just seems that jump really sticks as one of the defining moments in Strip history. Why do you think that is? And do you think, in part, is it because of its famous setting?
I think a lot of it is because it happened at Caesar's Palace. You know, that is such a great backdrop. I think the fact that he didn't make it successfully, the fact that he survived not making it successfully, kind of gives people a little bit of everything. They get to see the crash but not feel guilty about what happened at the crash. And I think it's just such a non sequitur. You would not expect to see that. I think that's why it is so remarkable so many years later.
And that's David Schwartz, gaming historian and author, as well as an ombuds and professor at UNLV. And we're talking about the enduring relevance of Caesar's Palace, which celebrates its 60th anniversary today, August 5th. Now, Caesar's didn't just create Vegas history. It also became a cultural phenomenon. And here to talk about that and the various ways it has entertained us is Jeff Carter, senior producer at Las Vegas Weekly and longtime arts entertainment writer. Jeff, welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
You know, I got to believe that Caesars has remained a force in Las Vegas in part because it's always been part of the cultural conversation of Las Vegas and really the whole country. You know, a lot of the times you think of Las Vegas, a lot of people think of Caesar's Palace and, of course, vice versa. Do you see a through line in how it's done that over the decades?
I think Caesar's Palace is the only Vegas property that has become more itself over the years. Properties lose their themes, they, you know, add on elements, they change. Caesar's has only gotten more Roman, more maximalist, more frankly crazy, and I think people love it for that.
Yeah, its design and decor, I feel, makes it a natural setting, especially for movies. I'm thinking of, you know, Rocky III, Rain Man, of course, Ocean's 11. I feel like if there's one film that really centered Caesar's Palace and could have almost just basically helped marketed the place, it's The Hangover. And I got to ask, what is it about its use in that movie that was so different from all the other titles that use that property?
It emphasized Caesar's as a wonderland, as a theme park, as a place where, you know, crazy things could happen. You could end up with a tiger in the room. You know, inexplicably, a mattress could get thrown off the roof and land on one of the statues. That was Vegas excess, or the idea of Vegas excess, meeting the place where it could truly bloom.
Now, the old Omnimax Theater, this is one of the first IMAX theaters in the country, used to be at Caesar's Palace, and it was replaced by a 4,000-seat concert venue called the Coliseum, built at first for its future resident performer, Celine Dion. That show was called A New Day, and it's often touted as the mold by which all the other Vegas concert residencies came from. Why does that show still hold that cultural distinction?
It merged concert and production in a way that I don't think had been done before, you know, at least on a, you know, on the basis of, you know, shows every night, that you could come in and hear this spectacular performance and then see this spectacular presentation over years was an incredible thing. And I think people have been trying to Xerox it since.
You know, later Caesars opened up Pure Nightclub, which was a kind of a zeitgeisty creating celebrity hotspot in the 2000s. 2011 comes along and they open Absinthe, still one of the most popular production shows on the Strip. Culturally, though, the 2020s era Caesar's Palace, I feel like, has made smaller cultural splashes. It obviously now has massive competition with dining and concert residencies and shopping. Do you think there's a development or trend adaptation that could put them back in the vanguard, in the mold breaking, or, you know, at least that would extend its legacy another decade or two?
First Consumption Lounge. No, I'm kidding. I have to believe that they're already on top of it. Caesars has always been excellent at predicting the trends and building out the most perfect version of them. They do a lot of things first. They do a lot of things best. Unfortunately, they also get bored quickly and switch things out. I think if Caesars wants to stay in the conversation, they need to look at the experiential economy. You know, people coming to Vegas wanting to do things that they can't do anywhere else and be seen doing things they can't do anywhere else.
And that's Jeff Carter of the Las Vegas Weekly. We also spoke to UNLV ombuds and gaming historian David Schwartz. Gentlemen, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mike.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Pravat, who oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. And before we get into it, a note, Live Nation is a financial supporter of Nevada Public Radio. Now let's get into it. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
We haven't spoken in a while, so I thought it'd be a good time to talk about First Fridays. We haven't talked about them in a while either, and it looks like there's something different happening this week.
There is, and no surprise, it is happening at Recycled Propaganda Gallery. That's right there on Main Street near Charleston. And we're going to talk about Brian Gibson. He is a local artist and musician, and he also works for the Goldwell Open Air Museum in Beatty. Now, his visual art, I'm probably not going to do it justice, but here goes. The aesthetic is very abstract. It's very experimental. It's largely brushes of paint going anywhere and everywhere. Sometimes it's adorned with text. Basically, there's a lot to look at within one painting. And he's going to have his largest visual art show to date starting August 7th. It's called One Day You'll Understand.
Sounds like something an artist might say in defense of his art.
It does sound pretty tongue-in-cheek, right? So let's say you can't make opening night on August 7th. You can also request appointment viewing through the month where Gibson will talk you through the pieces on display. And then at the end of the month, on Saturday, August 29th, he'll have a closing reception for the exhibit. And this will also serve as the album release event for something called In Relative Obscurity 3, Stay Here. This is the latest release by Gibson's experimental and ambient drone project called Obscured Relativity. And he recorded this at the Goldwell Museum. Now, spoiler alert, he used a Tascam recorder to catch the ambience of the Mojave to help build his wall of sound along with his guitar and other instruments.
Oh, Tascam reporters, the secret weapon of musicians and radio journalists alike. Well, for those who are looking for live entertainment, maybe that's also a little bit more on the intimate side. What you got for me, Mike?
So, have you ever seen the movie or stage production Hedwig and the Angry Inch?
I saw it in college, not knowing what I was about to see, and I'm still not sure I understand what I saw.
Yeah, you are not alone. I think I had that experience myself back in the day. For anyone who has not seen Hedwig, it is the story of a gay performer named Hansel. Hansel is forced into gender reassignment surgery to escape East Germany, but the surgery is botched, and then she assumes the persona of Hedwig, an androgynous, non-binary performer. She tours with a band to some of the saddest places you could ever imagine a band playing live. And this is all in the shadows of her lover, Tommy, who's touring as well, more successful, bigger venues. And Tommy is able to accomplish all that because of the music that Hedwig wrote.
So what came first, the movie or the musical?
So Hedwig the musical came out first. This is in 1998. It had a solid 2-year run off Broadway. And then James Cameron Mitchell, the creator of Hedwig, then made the movie, directed and acted in it. That came out in 2001, did some small indie release numbers, but it did eventually develop a cult following. Fast forward to now. And Hedwig the movie is now 25 years old. To celebrate that milestone, there's a 4K version that's being screened at a concert venue, House of Blues. And that's because this is followed by a story and question session by Mitchell himself, who then will play a short acoustic set, presumably the songs that are, you know, in the musical slash movie. And then on top of it, if you're going, there is a costume contest. And if you've seen the movie or the musical, you know this could make for a very colorful scene. And there are prizes. They come from the Punk Rock Museum and the Criterion Collection. That takes place on August 9th.
Oh, the Criterion Collection never really disappoints, does it?
Nope.
Speaking of theater, I hear you've got some stage suggestions for the Reno Tahoe area.
Yes, a tragedy and a comedy. For the former, you've got Sarah Bruner's version of Macbeth. That's playing tonight, August 5th. And Saturday, August 8th. And that's happening at the Sand Harbor State Park. And that's the venue for the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. I didn't actually know that that was a thing. Paul, I presume you knew.
I did know. I try to go every year. And personally, I like to splurge for the Adirondack seating near the front. It's fantastic.
Yeah, you should treat yourself. And if you don't want Macbeth, there's a more mainstream selection called The Heart of Robin Hood. That is not the comedy in question. The comedy in question is The Play That Goes Wrong. Paul, are you familiar?
I've seen it advertised on social media a lot over the last year, and I won't lie, the advertising has worked. I really want to see it.
Yeah, it is quite popular, and the premise, it's all in the title. Everything that goes wrong does. So much so that you barely have time to breathe between all the pratfalls and all the one-liners and everything hilarious that this 2015 play throws at you, and it is quite a bit. Melissa Taylor is directing this new classic, and you can take that in Thursdays through Sundays, and that's through August 16th at the Reno Little Theater. We'll have links online at KNPR.org.
I do imagine tickets will fly for that one.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Paul.